Oh, my. Get ready for this program. Space weapons. We think that they're being created, or that we want to create them, don't we, to fight off any other kinds of countries that exist on this planet. Oh, think again. In a moment, our guest, Dr. Michael Sala. Wait till you hear what he has to say on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He's the author of several books that include Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor, researcher, in residence of the School of International Service at the American University from 96 to 2004. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and he's also the founder of the Exopolitics Institute, which is a not-profit organization that analyzes the political implications of the extraterrestrial presence. In addition, he is the convener of the June 2006 Hawaii Conference on World Peace and Extraterrestrial Civilizations that will focus on space weapons issues, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. Welcome back, regular guest here on Coast to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm glad to be back.
Always a pleasure. What a topic tonight that so many people, I am sure, by the end of this program will just be scratching their heads saying, how is this possible? Let's go back a little bit, if we can, Michael, to your involvement in this kind of investigation of space weapons issues. And when you decided, hey, there's something else here, it may not be technology to fight off unfriendly governments on this planet. What happened?
Well, as you know, I've been researching the extraterrestrial presence for a few years now, ever since I heard the Disclosure Project press conference that Dr. Stephen Greer organized back in 2001. And I had heard about various crash retrievals and that these often happened with radar often playing a role, or was claimed that radar could somehow interfere with the navigation system of visiting extraterrestrial craft, and it was speculated that this was one of the reasons why the craft came down. And also there was speculation that some of these crashes were caused by electrical disturbances in the atmosphere, thunderstorms, lightning, so forth. So these were often the reasons given for why the ships would crash. And so I naturally assumed that this was probably something that didn't happen that often. It would probably be a phenomenon that would lead to the occasional crash retrieval. But as I began to do more research on this whole phenomenon around crash retrievals, I kept hearing the story that, well, the government is actually playing a much more proactive role in targeting extraterrestrial vehicles. And, of course, radar was one of those instruments that was often cited. But then I began to think about, well, what are the chances that they actually have developed more powerful systems that they just haven't disclosed to the general public? And so I began to kind of have an interest in space weapons, but it was only when Paul Hallier came forward back in September 2005.
And he's a former Canadian defense minister from years gone back, right?
That's right, from 1963 to 1967 in the Lester Pearson administration. He was the defense minister, and interestingly, he was the person in charge not only during the unification of the Canadian Armed Forces, but also the person that was involved in turning down the request from the Johnson administration to participate in a North American anti-ballistic missile defense shield. So he turned down that offer back then, along with Lester Pearson, of course, who was the prime minister. But in September 2005, he participated in a symposium in Toronto, and he focused on the space weapons issue in terms of, well, according to Philip Corso, who he believed was credible based on some of his own independent research, he was able to confirm through a U.S. Air Force general that Corso was actually who he claimed to be. And that,
okay, because Hallier had some of his own contacts in our military who knew of Corso, right?
That's correct. He was able to confirm through this U.S. Air Force general, who still remains anonymous, and also through some of his own contacts in the Canadian political system. I did speak to him about that, and he wasn't prepared to disclose who they were, but there were people within the Canadian system, political, military, who were able to also give their opinion about Corso. And so Hellyer, basically from this independent research, concluded that Corso was genuine. What he was talking about was real. And of course, Corso did raise the whole issue of the space weapons, because Corso was a very strong supporter of the Strategic Defense Initiative. And so Hellyer thought that this was a really important issue, and so he made that the focus of his talk, and really did bring out the policy implications of this, that if there's a Star Wars system that's being developed and being deployed, and that extraterrestrials are being targeted, that this should be a policy issue for all humanity rather than being confined to the secret committees that run the whole ET phenomenon.
And if they're being targeted, of course, that's one of the things we need to talk about tonight, Michael, why we need to target these alleged extraterrestrials, because there's something happening here, a much broader picture that everybody needs to be aware of. You know, I first really became aware of the Strategic Defense Initiative, of course, back during the Reagan administration in 1983. And I'll always remember, Doctor, the speech he made before the United Nations, where he talked about the need for us to band together in case we were, you know, confronted with a presence, an alien presence from above. My impressions were, isn't that a strange thing for a president to say? So I got to believe Reagan knew something that we didn't know at that time.
That's right. Reagan, I think, was briefed on some aspects of the extraterrestrial phenomenon. And whatever he was briefed on, he formed a conclusion based on all of those speeches at the UN and elsewhere, where he did talk about the extraterrestrial threat as being something that would require humanity to band together, that he, I believe, formed a conclusion in his own mind that extraterrestrials were a potential enemy that required the US and the USSR at the time to band together, to work together to prevent the extraterrestrials invading or taking over. Whatever he was briefed on or whatever knowledge he had, I think it was clear that he formed those opinions that were pretty rigid. And it's interesting that if you look at the series of comments he made as president, and Grant Cameron with the presidential UFO website, he has detailed that for not only Reagan but all the presidential administrations. But if you go to Reagan, what you see is that there's a succession of quotes where he does make references to these extraterrestrials being a potential threat. And Reagan wasn't the first. I mean, you go back to Douglas MacArthur back in 55, where he did clearly state that the next threat to humanity would be an interplanetary war. So Reagan was one along a number of officials that did believe that the next threat humanity would face would be an extraterrestrial one.
What is happening, at least publicly, between the United States, Russia, and China, the three superpowers that have the ability to create space weaponry? I mean, are we still kind of fighting, Michael? Is there, as you say, something else going on under the table that we haven't been told? What do you think's happening there on that front?
Well, I think there's quite a lot happening as far as space weapons are concerned. I think that they're all competing against one another to get the best space weaponry set up for themselves. But I think the U.S., because of its edge in terms of technology, the microchip and the advanced weapon development that it has pioneered. And the U.S., we need to remember, has a defense budget which dwarfs all the other nations. And I think even if you get the six top, other than the U.S., the other six nations who spend money on defense, the top six, they all still don't match what the U.S. spends. So the U.S. spends much more than all the others combined. And so it has an edge as far as space weaponry is concerned. Now, when it comes to the whole extraterrestrial phenomenon, I think that if we go back in the through the years, I think that at the very beginning of the whole phenomenon, back in the 40s and 50s, when they began to discover crashed disks, I believe that there was a decision made to cooperate as far as possible amongst the major powers to share this technology in a way that they wouldn't compete against one another, so that they could then be easily picked off by extraterrestrials who would make agreements with one side or the other. And I think it really is important to keep in mind that extraterrestrials have communicated, interacted with, and even reached agreements with different administrations. I think once you acknowledge that, then you can kind of start to get a grip on how this situation has developed, where you have extraterrestrial technologies being developed, being deployed, the major powers competing on one level, cooperating on other levels, and then you have space weapons that are being targeted against ETs. I think that we need to look at the agreements that were reached and why these agreements haven't quite lived up to what the potential was that has led to the space weapons issue, I think, taking the direction that it has of it being used against extraterrestrials.
I know, Michael, when you were on with me almost a little more than a year ago, when we were talking about the Eisenhower administration, and you had believed that they had cut a deal with extraterrestrials, and Dwight Eisenhower being one of the first presidents, I guess, to cut those kinds of deals, wasn't he?
That's correct. I think that there were other presidents who were aware of the UFO phenomenon. Truman and Roosevelt, for example, were aware of crashed UFOs, and there's good evidence to suggest that it was 1941 that was the very first crash. That's from Dr. Robert Wood and Ryan Wood, who investigated the Cape Girardeau crash.
Missouri, so was, yeah.
So that was 41. And Truman, of course, was responsible for setting up the Majestic Committee in 47. But from my own research, what I found was that the first evidence of actual meetings and agreements, that they occurred under the Eisenhower administration. And there was some link with the nuclear weapons development that was occurring. That's somehow, because the Eisenhower administration was forging ahead with developing the hydrogen bomb, thermonuclear weapons, that meetings with extraterrestrials occurred. And I believe what happened was agreements were reached with some extraterrestrial races and rather than others.
And did we have any negotiating power at all, Michael? Because it would seem to me that they had all the cards.
Well, that's the key question, George. I'm glad you raised that, because that is exactly the point that Philip Corso made in the day after Roswell. And he did refer to these agreements. And the way he described it was, he said, we had negotiated a kind of surrender with them because they knew what we feared most was disclosure. So there you have, in a very succinct expression, really, in a nutshell, the dilemma confronting the U.S. when it comes to dealing with extraterrestrials, because in reaching agreements with extraterrestrials, if you fear disclosure, if you fear that they're kind of simply going to show up over the major cities and say, hey, we're here, then they're going to be able to leverage a better agreement, a more suitable agreement. And people like Corso, what they suggest is that whatever agreements were reached, many people in the military were unhappy with them. They felt that they were unfair agreements. The extraterrestrials took advantage of the U.S. negotiators and basically drove a hard bargain. And people like Corso, and this is really important to understand where space weapons come in, they believe that space weapons would level the playing field or would strengthen the negotiating position of the U.S. And that's really, I think, very important, because this is all about strengthening the negotiating position of the U.S. in dealing with extraterrestrials. There's no threat.
I want to get back to the moment here when they started to negotiate with them, Michael, but what do you think happened for us to want to create the space weaponry in order to combat them? I mean, first of all, for a good defense for this country, because futuristically, I think you're going to need weapons in space. I mean, unfortunately, this is not a planet where you can just be good guys all the time. If somebody else is going to do it, it might as well be us. But what do you think occurred for us even to consider having space weapons for extraterrestrial intervention?
Well, CORSO, I think, really does give us a way of understanding the perspective of the military that were behind the development of space weapons. For CORSO, the extraterrestrials were performing a number of activities that he believed were invasive, that were violating the sovereignty of the U.S. in terms of airspace, that interaction with citizens was something that was very much a major concern for CORSO and other military people, and the abduction phenomenon. I think that the abduction phenomenon really frightened the military because, I mean, when you look at the abduction phenomenon, what you have is people being taken up in numbers far greater than anything that the U.S. might have envisaged as a part of whatever agreement it had reached with extraterrestrials.
And against their will, right?
That's the key here. It was against their will. And even though many people came back and said, well, it wasn't so bad. I went through some kind of medical procedure. But nevertheless, it was against their will. And many people were traumatized by this. And so I think what happened was that through the monitoring of these abductions, CORSO and the military people were able to create a profile of what the ET motivations were, and I think that they concluded that they were not very benevolent, and so they really were very concerned about this. They felt that they couldn't stop it, that whatever agreements were reached, that these agreements were somehow being violated or were unfair, and so they began to consider space weapons or ways in which you could kind of force the ETs to stop doing things that concern the military.
So, did we actually, though, Michael, create weaponry that could combat hostile ETs when they had the kind of technology to get here?
Well, this is one of the things that we need to look at in terms of covert projects and overt, like black projects versus white projects. As you know, the black projects are things that we rarely hear about. It's only when a few whistleblowers come forward that mm-hmm. we get to learn a little bit about these and what's going on. And for example, through various whistleblowers, we learn a little bit about the HAARP technology, that high-frequency active auroral research project is much more than just kind of shooting high-frequency radio waves into the ionosphere, that there's much more to it than that, and we'll come back to that. But that's kind of like an example of a black project because there's nothing that's officially announced to say that this is a weapon system.
But but to me, though, it would be like trying to build a bow and arrow against a submachine gun technology. I can't understand how we could even think that whatever we could create, even if we had, let's say, lasers, and we'll talk about technology in just a moment, that anything would be better than what they might already have.
Well, what is known is that from the extensive number of crash retrievals that have occurred, that many of these occur in ways that would suggest that their navigation systems have been interfered with or their propulsion systems have been damaged in some way. And typically, some of the explanations are either radar, high-powered radar that's being used by the military, either natural atmospheric events like lightning storms, or another possibility is nuclear detonations in the upper atmosphere. I mean, we know that there has been testing of nuclear weapons in the upper atmosphere, and so there may be some relationship between the testing of nuclear weapons in the upper atmosphere and many of these crash retrievals.
Well, I guess maybe they don't have the ability to put up shields around them. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest tonight, Dr. Michael Sala on Coast to Coast AM. Well, they're going like hotcakes. 14 issues for the price of 12. That's the After Dark newsletter. As a matter of fact, the April issue will highlight none other than old Alex Jones. Alex will be talking and writing about some very interesting things that you can get only in the After Dark newsletter. 14 issues for the price of 12. How do you get it? Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or go online, coasttocoastam.com. Michael, in your research, are other countries involved in any kind of negotiations with extraterrestrials, or is it just the United States?
Well, I do know that other countries have participated in the crash retrieval process. So there have been some instances of cooperation with the U.S., with these other countries in terms of relocating the technology. And so that, to me, would suggest that these other countries have more or less accepted the role of the U.S. as being the leading earthly nation to basically make agreements and deal with the extraterrestrial phenomenon. So that would basically point to the U.S. being the one that, that has made the agreements. I haven't heard of other countries making agreements to the same extent as the U.S., but then again, so little information has come out of the former Soviet Union regarding the official response to extraterrestrials, that we're not quite sure exactly what they did. I mean, we, for example, we haven't had too many whistleblowers come forward from the Soviet system saying that the Soviets have reached agreements, but we have had a number of people coming forward saying that discs were recovered, sightings occurred quite frequently. So we know that from, say, from Russia. But I would say that the U.S. is basically the country which has made the agreements, and other countries are kind of playing secondary roles.
Speculate a little bit here for us, Michael, just so we can get an idea of what may have happened. But kind of outline for us the type of agreement, how something occurred for the agreement even to start, and what you think the negotiations were. Just kind of like give us an example of what you think might have happened.
Well, I think that's probably pretty easy to understand. It's very similar to when, say, an advanced industrial country visits a less developed or very primitive society. Agreements are reached where the primitive society will get advanced technology in the form of communications, transportation, and so forth. And in exchange, the advanced power pulls out resources. And I think that's pretty much what happened with the U.S. and visiting extraterrestrial races. The U.S. military wanted whatever technology they could get, and they wanted to learn how to use it. And I think that agreements were reached where they would get both the technology and also get some assistance in learning how to use this technology. And in exchange, they were able to give to the extraterrestrial a number of benefits in terms of being able to extract Earth resources, and we're talking about natural resources, and we also know about biological resources. We know, for example, abductions have been happening, and that part of the abduction process has been the extraction of biological resources or biological material, DNA and so forth, genetic material, from the individuals who have been abducted. And of course, the natural resources, there's metals, there's water, and also bases, that there have been agreements where extraterrestrials have been able to establish bases in various locations, and I believe one of those locations is Nellis Air Force Base, just out there by Las Vegas.
Now, in terms of the abductions, do you believe the extraterrestrials ever honestly told us what they wanted to do with human beings?
Well, I assume that they probably saw it as an opportunity to extract biological resources, genetic material from a very diverse population, and the government really didn't understand the significance of that, and the government probably didn't really care too much. I mean, and here we're talking about the military, that what they really were concerned about was getting technology, learning how to use that technology, and getting whatever information they needed for developing that technology and deploying it within their own military infrastructure. And in exchange, the extraterrestrials were able to perform the abductions. And as far as they were concerned, I think that the military kind of didn't really care too much about what exactly was going to be occurring to these people, because they were more concerned about the technology. And so I think that probably what happened was that the extraterrestrials justified in their own minds that, well, you know, this nation, or the leaders of this nation, don't really care too much about the population or the people who get taken up. So if we take up more than we were permitted to by the agreements, and if we do more than what we were permitted to, well, that's not going to be a big problem because the military are really interested in technology. And I think they probably deduced that the military really didn't care about what would truly happen to people who were caught up in these abduction scenarios, and probably the extraterrestrials justified it in their own minds as something that was appropriate.
How many individuals do you think did they take every year, or since this whole agreement has been in force?
Well, I've seen estimates, and I know the estimates go into the millions in the U.S. alone. And so that suggests that they took many more than what the agreement suggested. And I have come across a number of whistleblowers who have said that that was indeed what occurred, that whatever agreements were reached, that this would be something that would have fixed a particular limit to how many people could be abducted, because I think that the people making the agreements on our side, the military and the government, they understood that this was kind of like a resource to be traded. You know, you want technology, well then, you know, if you want to take more people up into your abduction program to extract biological material for whatever they're doing in terms of hybridization or genetic engineering, that there would be technology that would be given in exchange for that. So I think whatever limits were reached were greatly exceeded by the extraterrestrials. And I think that's something that we can deduce from a number of whistleblowers who have come forward to say that kind of situation has occurred.
And Michael, did everybody come back? Did they return them, or did they keep a whole bunch?
Well, if we go back to Corso, this is what I think he is important, because I think he reflects the mindset of the military in the time and what they believe. And I think it's clear from what Corso wrote that from the perspective of the military, not everyone came back. That many, I think the vast majority, were returned, and basically returned unharmed, kind of like the way in which scientists will go out into the wild and kind of stun animals and tag them and maybe extract some biological material for testing and whatever, and then kind of let them go. But occasionally some animals would be taken and they wouldn't be returned into the wild, and maybe they would they would die in the process. And I think something like that was happening as well with the abduction phenomenon, and that was one of the things that Corso believed made the extraterrestrials a potential enemy in his mind, and why the kind of Star Wars or the space weapons scenario was, in his view, a very important thing to do.
So the agreements came first, and then the weaponry in space came after that. Something happened then. We decided to change the deal.
Well, I think what happened was that Corso and people in the military who were parties to these agreements understood that the first agreements that were reached were probably unfair, because, as Corso said, you know, what they feared was disclosure.
It's like going to a guy, Michael. You've got a gun, and you say, "All right, this is the way it's going to come down. This is the deal." I mean, you have no choice, right?
Exactly. I think that's what Corso and others believed, that the ETs had this gun in the form of disclosure, that they could just simply appear above the major cities in the U.S. and all of a sudden the whole country would know that this is real. Disclosure would have happened and there would be a kind of societal collapse. And we need to remember that the Brookings Institution report from 1961, that after they were commissioned from NASA, the Brookings Institution basically concluded that if extraterrestrial civilizations, if the knowledge of that was made public, that could lead to a societal collapse. And I think the military truly believe that there could be a collapse of society, and we could be easily taken over if there's that kind of collapse. So I think there was, in a sense, a kind of metaphorical gun to the head of the military through this kind of disclosure process. And I think that the space weapons was something that the military believed could stop the ETs from exercising that kind of advantage in the future. Because I think what we need to look at was, this wasn't just a one-off set of negotiations and agreements. This was the start of a process that has continued. And I think we can look at this then in terms of, how does the US government military, who is privy to this information, how do they get the best deal from extraterrestrials who have shown themselves to be very capable and very competent negotiators? Space weapons was one way of doing that, and I think that's why it's been given so much emphasis.
Next hour, I want to get into the specifics of what you think we might have up there and whether we've been doing some shooting. We've all seen some incredible video from space. There are some people out there, though, Michael, who think we're being set up by a world that wants a one-world government, being set up by a world that basically, after we're all done fighting each other, we need another villain. And in order to continue to spend money on military hardware, and in order to put and wither away more of our rights, in order to take control of us, we need another villain. And we're not going to have a villain on this planet. So there are some people who believe we're being set up, that one day the villain will be extraterrestrials who may not exist based on their thoughts. And all of a sudden governments will say, oh my God, we're being attacked. We're being invaded. We need to do this. And they're going to just do it. What do you think of that theory?
Well, it definitely exists out there. The report from Iron Mountain that was released in 1967, that actually made the New York Times bestseller list. And that had within it a number of passages referring to extraterrestrials and UFOs as being something that would be suitable in terms of creating an enemy image to maintain the various functions of war, which were seen to be necessary for a healthy society. So this report from Iron Mountain was put out there to basically get people to think that the UFO ET phenomenon was something that tied into this long-term agenda of the world government to perpetuate a war economy, to be able to someday turn around and say ETs, UFOs are a threat. And of course, the report from Iron Mountain was suggesting that this was a contrived threat, or that this was a concocted enemy. In other words, UFOs and ETs weren't real at all. And I think that's one way of looking at it, that the UFO-ET phenomenon wasn't real, and that so this was something that was being faked to maintain a war economy. And so I think that the report from Iron Mountain kind of put that idea out there. And so I think that was probably a result of a very clever disinformation policy orchestrated by one or more of the alphabet agencies to get that report out there. I mean, ultimately it was shown to be a hoax. Someone stepped forward to claim that the report from Iron Mountain was a hoax. But nevertheless, people still believe that, they say it's a hoax, but in fact it's the official policy. So I think there are many people who genuinely believe that the UFO phenomenon is actually not real, that it's just a contrived phenomenon because the government wants to make it the next threat. And there's side.
Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, co-authored with William Burns. I know Bill very well. He's writing a book with me that's going to be published in a few months. But prior to really getting to know Bill Burns, I thought, like so many other people thought, come on now, who is this Corso guy? Is he making up this story now that he's retired? And after talking with Bill Burns, I have come to the belief, Michael, that Corso was telling the truth. That's my theory.
I would have to agree with you. I mean, the things he said are backed up by the positions he held. I mean, this is a man who did serve within the Eisenhower administration. I mean, he was involved in a number of top secret committees that were dealing with covert operations. And some of those covert operations, I believe, did deal with the UFO phenomenon. And here I'm talking about the Operations Coordinating Board and the Psychological Strategy Board. These are two committees that Corso served on that were part of the National Security Council and the White and the Eisenhower administration. They were part of that network. And he served on those. And we also know that Corso was a battalion commander at White Sands Missile Range, and that he had a UFO encounter there. And we also know that he did serve at the Foreign Technology Desk and actually headed that desk. So this is a man who held some very important positions with a lot of responsibility, and he was saying that part of his job description at the Foreign Technology Desk involved putting out into the civilian industry this technology that the Pentagon or that the Army had left over from the Roswell crash. So I think that he is genuine because his testimony is corroborated by documents that show that he did serve in those positions. His statements are consistent. He didn't change his story. And he went out and was interviewed by many people who could see how sincere and how much integrity he had. So I would have to agree with you that, yes, he's definitely someone who is to be believed.
Even his notes are consistent with the things he has written about and the things that he said.
Well, that's right. I mean, those private notes that are shortly going to be published, I believe, by Bill Burns, the original notes that Corso used, I mean, they also detail many of the incidents that occurred to him while he was at White Sands, while he was at the Foreign Technology Desk. And they always point to him having these various security clearances that gave him access to this UFO information. I mean, he was always pointing out that this was not information that was freely available to people in the military. You needed to have the right security clearances. You needed to have that need to know. And because Corso did have that, because he was an intelligence officer and he did serve in the Eisenhower administration in some very sensitive projects. I mean, basically, the Operations Coordinating Board was the committee that was dealing with creating covert operations involving the Pentagon, the CIA, the NSA, the State Department. This was the body that was coordinating all of those different agencies and departments in putting together covert operations ostensibly to deal with the communist threat, but I think it would probably included the UFO phenomenon as well. So this is a man who served on those committees, so he would have had those very sensitive clearances that he did have, and so I think it's entirely plausible that he had that kind of information.
Next hour, when we come back, Michael, let's talk about some of the technology, and also I want to get your take on who you think might be visiting us. Because I've heard that there could be a number of different, I guess, species of extraterrestrials that have been coming to this planet. Do you hear the same thing?
Definitely, yes. We're hearing numbers that range all up into the 60s or 100s.
Of different kinds?
That's right. I've heard those kinds of estimates.
All right, let's talk about that when we come back as well. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM with our special guest, Dr. Michael Sala.